Orbital Gardens, this is Mission Control. We are confirming acquisition of your signal. You are live in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello and welcome to Gardeners of the Galaxy, the podcast for all of the sentient beings in the universe who have a passion for plants. I am Emma the Space Gardener and I will be your host as we explore gardening on Earth and beyond. One of the interesting things that happened recently is that a capsule from Varda Space Industries landed back on Earth with its cargo of crystals that were grown in orbit. Although private companies have returned space-made products to Earth before, this is the first time they've done so with their own uncrewed capsule. Varda's goal is to make in-space manufacturing more efficient and cost-effective using capsules that double as factory and return vehicle. Their first test mission, named W1, carried materials to grow crystals of ritonavir, an antiviral drug used to treat HIV and hepatitis C. The plan was to bring the crystals back to Earth after a month or two in orbit, but the company ran into delays getting re-entry clearance from the FAA and the US military. Assuming the crystals have turned out well and survived their fiery trip home, we could soon see more products produced in space and returned to Earth. Will any of those involve plants? We'll have to wait and see. Our mission specialist for this episode is Patrick Grubbs, who recently completed a professional science master's degree in controlled environment agriculture at the University of Arizona. Patrick is one of the people behind the Space Ecology Workshop, an annual virtual symposium on bioregenerative life support, space agriculture, closed ecological systems, and more. He also co-founded the Spring Institute for Forests on the Moon, an international non-profit research organisation developing closed ecological life support technology and working to democratise space access in underrepresented countries. The Spring Institute is working on some really exciting astrobotany projects, and we'll be hearing more about those in just a moment. Before we get to that, I'd like to thank each and every one of you who supports the show, whether that's via a financial contribution or by sharing it with friends and colleagues. Gardeners of the Galaxy wouldn't exist without you. And if you haven't already discovered the Gardeners of the Galaxy Mission Report, it's a weekly email newsletter packed with astrobotany news and updates. To subscribe, visit theunconventionalgardener.com and click the newsletter link in the top right corner. Hi, Patrick. It's great to have you on the show today.
Hey, how are you, Emma? Glad to be here.
I'm good. Thank you. So we've got a lot to talk about today because you have a lot of things going on. So why don't you start by telling me how you got involved, how you became interested in space plants?
Yeah, sure. I think I had the story won't be unfamiliar to most people who got into botany. I think I started off doing biology because I was interested in animals, just like everybody else. But then as part of my biology undergraduate degree, I was forced to take a botany class. And I wasn't really looking for it was that or microbiology, and botany sounded easier. However, I had this incredible professor who just like totally opened my eyes. Like really shifted the trajectory of my life, I guess. She made it apparent that plants are actually just as interesting as animals. They have all of these behaviors and like responses, we just don't see them. And after that, I got really into plants and I realized that I was actually interested in the interaction of plants and animals and microbes. And that is essentially ecology, which is where I am now. So that's how I got started, yeah.
Brilliant. No, that's awesome. It's just like somebody opened your eyes to plants and it's like, wow, they're everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, plant blindness, it's so real.
It is.
And you just have to have some sort of event that opens your eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So some people who are listening might already be familiar with you because they've probably attended your fantastic space ecology workshops. So tell me about those.
Yeah, sure. Well, this is a good segue into my application of plants, which is I am particularly interested in plants in the context of closed ecological systems, such as a terrarium, because you can imagine that the Earth is one really huge closed ecological system.
Yep.
And if we wanted to go live in space, we would need to, well, I think we should bring a closed ecological system with us so that it can do all of the same things it's doing for us on Earth, like recycling your waste and your air, providing food, that kind of stuff. So the Space Ecology Workshop was born out of a need to get people talking about closed ecological systems in the context of space. I had a couple of buddies in the industry, like engineers that have worked at NASA and stuff, and there's an interesting divide between hard physicochemical engineers, like people who are working on machines to do things, and engineers like bioengineers, people who are interested in using like biological solutions to problems. And a lot of us think that we need those biological solutions in space for sustainable space habitation. So we started the Space Ecology Workshop to get all those people in one room. We've done it twice now. It's been so much fun. We've had some incredible speakers. I'm always really excited to do it every year.
It's amazing. And I guess you've got one coming up. It'll be in the autumn and the fall, won't it?
Yes, that's the plan. We are planning to do the virtual event somewhere, yeah, in the fall, maybe October again. We try to keep it like a little bit distant from all the other space conferences because people only have so much tolerance for that.
I will put the link to the website in the show notes so people can keep an eye out for that then, so because that will be awesome. Okay, so I mean, one of the other things that you're part of sounds absolutely fascinating and I don't know much about. It's the Spring Institute for Forests on the Moon. So what's that?
Yes, I am really excited to tell you about that. So the Spring Institute for Forests on the Moon is a nonprofit research and development organization, which is international, although it's registered in France. I co-founded it along with a few other people at the end of 2022. We all met in Toulouse, France at the MELISSA conference, which stands for Micro Ecological Life Support Alternative. It's the European Space Agency's program to work on these bioregenerative life support habitats. And so we all met there, and my co-founder Louise gave this presentation about what if we just grew a forest on the moon? What would we learn? And we were all like, damn, what would we learn? That sounds really cool. Yeah, I mean, myself and some other people were really excited about the idea. And so we got together and we submitted a proposal to the European Space Agency, not specifically for the forest quite yet, but we actually submitted a proposal to send an aquarium to the International Space Station. Yeah, and this mission was accepted. We've been developing it for more than a year now. We just passed our preliminary design review. Yay, us. But the idea is, it is related to the forest. The idea is we need to establish that ecosystems still work in space. There have been plenty of biology experiments flown in space, but very, very, very few ones that are like multi-trophic, that have, plants and animals and microbes. And if they did have that, they weren't investigating them as a whole. So we just have to validate that ecosystems work, and then we can talk about how we're going to put them on the moon.
What's going to be in your aquarium?
So the aquarium is actually based on the ecosphere, which is a product you might be familiar with. It's kind of a desk ornament paperweight. It's a glass sphere that has maybe half a liter of water in it. And inside the sphere is a handful of shrimp and some microalgae, basically. And these things are incredible. They can live with no input other than sunlight for like a decade or more. I have like a lot of anecdotal evidence from people who have these that have like been watching one shrimp live in this ball for 20 years. It's actually crazy. So this is an example of a self-sustaining ecosystem, a good place to start building your bigger ecosystem off of. So since it's particularly resilient, we chose to fly that system to space. But at the same time, the Spring Institute is working on a lot of other projects because our ultimate goal is to put a forest on the moon, but to do that, we're going to develop closed ecological life support technologies for both Earth and space. Because, of course, in the light of climate change, Earth is becoming more extreme. And in order for us to live in this extreme environment, we need to live sustainably with our surroundings, like in a very literal sense. We need to know inputs and outputs and closed material loops. And so that's what we're working on. And also, I do want to point out the Spring Institute has equally important secondary goal of education and outreach for those communities that are not really very well represented in the space race right now. And one of the ways we're working on that is we partner with like local organizations and host space hackathon events. In fact, we've got two of them happening in just over a week in Rwanda, in Tunisia. So if you guys are in town, maybe you could come visit.
Awesome, that would be awesome. You mentioned I guess that was the Scampi aquarium that has the shrimp in it, but you've got a
That's right.
terrarium you're working on as well?
Yes. So one of our other really big projects at the Spring Institute, we're calling it Plant B. I have to confess, we haven't actually figured out what the letters mean yet. We just really like the acronym. It's pretty catchy. And
I don't think it has to
so
be an acronym. That's an awesome name.
it does have to be an acronym for sure. Yeah, so Plant B is kind of a sister mission for the Scampi project, where Scampi is an aquarium going to the ISS. Plant B is a whole CubeSat terrarium that's just going to be in low Earth orbit. And the idea with this one is there's a couple of interesting innovations, but they're mostly engineering. And the primary one is, we don't have any, we have greenhouses on Earth where we just passively use light and heat from the sun. But whenever we're trying to grow plants in space, it's in the veggie habitat or in the advanced plant habitat, which are really good examples of controlled environment agriculture. But we have still all of that sunlight in space, so why aren't we using it?
Absolutely.
That's the idea behind Plant B. We're gonna put a tiny greenhouse terrarium in space, and we did this thermal modeling simulation that was funded by the French Space Agency, and we found that with the proper blend of reflective gold material and transparent polycarbonate, you can completely passively keep the inside of a little terrarium at like perfectly livable temperatures between 20 and 30 degrees Celsius throughout the whole orbit of, like a 90-minute orbit around the Earth. Never leaves this 10-degree range, but interestingly, the amount of light it receives during this is insane. You can imagine that we filter quite a lot of sunlight through our atmosphere, and by the time it hits the surface of the Earth, if you're on like the equator on a summer day, you're getting about 2,000 micromoles per second, whatever PPFD is, I can't ever remember. You're getting 2,000 PPFD. If you're in low Earth orbit, you're getting like 2 million
Oof.
PPFD. And
That's
so,
a heck of a suntan.
yeah, that's right. So really the biggest thing is going to be filtering out as much light as possible.
You wouldn't think of that, would you, if you're in Earth's orbit, in low Earth orbit, you wouldn't think too much light would be the problem.
Yeah, no, you're always thinking about the heat, really. Like, how can you dissipate all of this extra heat? And our experiment isn't going to generate heat because, well, except for very tiny metabolic amounts, it's more about just keeping like a neutral heat balance, which is an interesting problem. And obviously, the application for this sort of thing is you could scale it up and put a whole greenhouse in space growing actual food.
Awesome. I mean, have you given much thought yet to the plants that are going to grow in this terrarium? Have you whittled it down to a short list yet?
Yeah, this is an ongoing. We actually developed a whole bunch of experiments to kind of determine this because we're calling it the orbital environment, and it's really unique. Like I said, there's the orbit takes about 90 minutes, and during that time, like depending on your trajectory and stuff, you're probably in sunlight for about 60 minutes, and you're eclipsed by the Earth for 30 minutes. So having a photo period of 60 minutes of light and 30 minutes of dark is super weird.
It is.
There's nowhere on Earth is it like that. So you've got to pick plants that can tolerate that. So we are coming at it from a few different angles. The first one is that we're doing an investigation in Wales at the University of, I'm about to butcher the name, University of Aberystwyth.
Aberystwyth.
Oh, you got it. Thank you.
Aberystwyth, yes.
Perfect. Yes,
That's one
that's
of
it.
the easier ones in
Oh,
Wales.
geez. I'm glad I don't know the hard ones. Yeah, we've got a few students there who are part of the team. Like the Spring Institute is composed of entirely volunteers and quite a lot of students and early career professionals. And they're just in about 1 week, they're going to start this photo period experiment where they are testing different photosynthetic pathways, which one is best adapted to this 60 minutes of light, 30 minutes of dark photo period. So we're going to have three or four plants that are C3 plants, C4 plants, and CAM plants. We're going to put them all in here and see how they do compared to their controls in a normal photo period. And
Interesting.
that will help to, it'll begin to suggest what we should be putting in this terrarium, but ultimately we will repeat this experiment again in actual terrariums with actual assemblages of plants and invertebrates and stuff. I expect that at the end, we're going to end up with some sort of moss mix that has some tiny herbaceous weeds in it recruited from the soil bank.
I was going to go with a spider plant because they are so unkillable. I think they're just, they're going to be the ultimate space plant.
I don't disagree with you. However, they get pretty big, and our terrarium is going to be kind of small because we're working with this CubeSat format. And cube satellites are standardized. It's a standard unit of measurement for small satellites. One unit is like 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters. We are using a 3-unit cube satellite. But of course, you have to have all the other pieces of a satellite in there. So the actual payload of a terrarium only occupies 1.5 units. So the volume of the terrarium is less than a liter. Not a lot of space for a spider
No, very small spider plant.
plant.
Okay, so I mean, I can see lots of plants and lights on the shelf behind you, and as well as all these projects that you're involved with, you're doing your master's degree, aren't you, at the University of Arizona?
I actually just finished it.
You
I
just
kind
finished.
of did
Oh,
that.
congratulations.
Yep. Thank you very much. Yeah, I went back to school last year and I did like a whirlwind year and I finished the whole program in 1 year and now I
That's a
am a
major slog. Yeah.
Yeah, tell me
Well
about
done,
it.
you.
Thank you. Yeah, but I got this really cool degree in controlled environment agriculture now, so I feel equipped to try putting some plants in space.
Amazing. So,
Yeah.
you mentioned to me some of the projects that you're involved with as part of your master's. So what were those that your more personal stuff that you've been working on?
Well, to be honest, the subject of my master's was mostly growing the Spring Institute. Yeah, and to be fair, there's quite a few other projects that I haven't talked about yet. For example, we are trying to bioremediate lunar regolith so that we can grow plants in it. Because, of course, when we get to the point of growing our forest on the moon, we're not doing that
No.
hydroponically. So.
Well, I don't know.
There's going to be a tree growing in moon dirt at some point, and we're going to figure out how that goes. Is it different than regular plants growing in lunar regolith? We'll see. Another thing that I'm super interested about with lunar regolith is, when you grow a forest on Earth, it doesn't just start off as trees. You have to go through the whole process of ecological succession. This bare rock will be colonized by biocrusts, which give way to mosses and lichens. Eventually, you get grasses and other herbaceous plants and shrubs, and they create the microenvironment that's appropriate for trees. So I want to repeat this whole process on the moon, but also I want to do it fast enough that I'll be alive when it's finished. So.
Supercharged succession.
Exactly. So one of the things, actually, I just started this like a week or two ago, is we're looking at primary ecological succession on lunar regolith, which is, there's a lot of ways to tackle this, but I'm really excited about this extremely simple thing where I have two buckets of lunar regolith, and I mixed 10% sphagnum moss into one of them, so it has some water retention, some nutrient retention, a little organic matter. And the other one is just straight regolith. And I have left them outside on my balcony. And, Seattle is a pretty rainy, wet place. So I figure it's a good place to breed microbes. I'm just going to be monitoring these two pots for the next few years. And I'm going to mark, I've got like observations I'm supposed to take, but it's going to be really cool to mark milestones. Like, when did mosses recruit, like, volunteer to grow on this substrate? If you, so this is kind of like a thought experiment of, if I had a biodome on the surface of the moon and it had like, an atmosphere, but nothing living inside of it, what if I just opened up my terrarium and left it there? Like
What would you get?
what would happen? How would
Yeah.
life spread? I'm really excited to see how resilient our life is to this lunar regolith, which is a pretty harsh substrate.
It is, yeah. Even so, I think if I had two buckets like that in my garden, it would be like wall-to-wall dandelions in about 5 minutes. This is like the weediest
Yes.
place on earth around here.
That would be a success in my book. That's adding organic matter to the soil.
I'm not growing anything, those things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I know that the Spring Institute has a lot of projects on the go, but you've got a special one that might be a citizen science project, is that right?
Yeah, that is right. One of the things I worked on last summer at my internship at the Spring Institute was this project that we're calling TerraScape. And TerraScape is a do-it-yourself terrarium kit that's supposed to be assemblable by, a 12-year-old kid or something. And the idea is that you're delivered a box that you assemble this terrarium kit and you create a closed ecosystem, which is standardized.
Yeah.
You put in a specific amount of plants, you put in a specific amount of dirt, and we're trying to create like a terrarium ecosystem template that
Yeah.
we can use to generate data. The idea is that we actually don't know very much about how ecosystems function, and
No.
ecology is a really young science. But then the problem is like ecosystems are almost never replicable. So if you wanted to do like a really long-term study on ecosystems, because ecosystems are on an ecological timescale,
Yeah.
you need millions of data. Well, that's an exaggeration. You need a lot of data points over a long time. And that's not feasible to do by yourself without tons of funding. So my idea is to send these kits to people around the world, have them create a terrarium, and then inside of the terrarium, there is a sensor suite which connects to like a phone app via Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, and it automatically uploads sensor data from each terrarium. And also, there are some manual data measurements that we want to try to convince people to take as well.
Yeah.
And the idea here is that this is a sort of self-funded citizen science experiment that distributes the labor of getting data from hundreds of different data points.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that over the course of some years, we can get like tons and tons of data about how closed ecosystems change over time based on their environment, based on their initial setup state. And this could be really crucial for informing like how ecosystem stability, what are signs of ecosystem health, what does an ideal terrarium composition look like? There's so many questions we haven't answered yet, and I
Yeah.
think it'd be really cool to get people involved in
That would be
answering them.
really cool, having a smart terrarium in your living room.
Yeah,
It's just like,
exactly.
yeah,
Yep.
connecting to this sort of terrarium hive mind in the background. That's
Yeah.
awesome.
IoT is the Internet of Terrariums.
That would be absolutely phenomenal. I hope that comes to pass. So I will keep an eye on that one.
Yeah, we'll let you know.
Okay, so you talk there about wanting to grow a forest on the moon and accelerate that process so it happens within your lifetime. Have you thought about wanting to go to space? Is that something you would like to do?
I mean, like who doesn't? I didn't get into this career because I wanted to be an astronaut.
Yeah.
I think like I've always been interested in science and stuff, but I think that as a kid, an astronaut is the most elite job possible. Those are the best of humanity. So it wasn't even really on my radar.
No.
Space wasn't really on my radar until I realized it was the only application of these closed ecological systems. So if I had the opportunity, I would love to go to space. I don't really expect to go live on the moon myself, though.
No. Okay, so imagine that you are going on a trip into space, maybe to see your forest, maybe not. You're going to be there a while. You can take one plant with you as your personal pet plant. What do you choose and why?
I've listened to this podcast for a long time and I've heard this question many times and I still don't have the answer, but today I'm going to decide. I guess I'd have to pick the plant that started it all, which was the one When I took that botany class at the very beginning of the semester, our professor gave everyone a tiny little Kalanchoe plantlet.
Oh, okay.
And she said, whoever has the biggest one at the end of the semester gets extra credit. But I got my girlfriend's plant from the previous semester, so I had the biggest one. So I would have to say Kalanchoe diagra montiana, mother of thousands.
Okay, they're pretty, aren't they? When they flower,
Yeah,
they're
and they're
pretty.
tenacious. They're tenacious, and they want to spread life, which I think is what I'm doing too.
Awesome. It sounds like you are spreading a lot of life through the universe, so that is absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm trying my best.
Well, Patrick, it has been absolutely brilliant having you on the show today. Thank you for coming on and telling us about some of your wonderful projects.
Yeah, thanks. This has been a real joy. I've loved this conversation.
Oh, fantastic. Maybe you'll come back one day and give us an update on how things are going.
I would love to.
Bye-bye, Patrick.
See ya.
Thanks again to Patrick for coming on the show and sharing some of the marvellous astrobotany projects he's involved with. Don't forget that you can find the show notes on the website at theunconventionalgardener.com. You can also sign up to the Gardeners of the Galaxy newsletter for new episode alerts and bonus astrobotany content. That's it for this episode, so I'll hand you back to Mission Control. Capcom, I think it's just about time for a cuppa, don't you?
Orbital Gardens, this is Mission Control, confirming termination of your signal. We have activated the auto kettle and your T-1.